Access seems like it should be straightforward. But even when we try to make spaces accessible, there are all these little, almost invisible decisions that get in the way. A step at the front entrance, a door that's heavy or a few inches too narrow, an outlet that is just out of reach. These aren't just minor inconveniences, though. They're barriers, and they can turn a place that's supposed to be home into something that feels anything but. In this episode, we're going to dig into those barriers and ask the questions: where do they come from? Why do they stick around? And what would it actually take to design spaces that are truly inclusive? I'm Megan Miller.
I'm Zachary Weeks.
And this is
Accessing Home.
How would you describe yourself?
More so in the last 6 months. I've always been an advocate for people with disabilities, but even more so now, because my condition has gotten worse over the last 6 months, and I've had to really become my own advocate.
This is Michelle Bissell. She's the education coordinator with the Voice of Albertans with Disabilities and has lived experience of cerebral palsy.
Well, I was born with my physical disability. And then 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with osteoarthritis in my hip. And I was totally independent before I was diagnosed with arthritis. And now I use an electric chair and I need help with things that I've never needed help with. My whole life got turned upside down. Mm-hmm. Basically. And it's hard. Just last night at Easter dinner with my parents, I said to my mom, you know what, a year ago we had Easter dinner at your place and I was walking. And so it's hard. It's all fresh. My life just changed really quickly.
Michelle lives in Art Space, the cooperative we introduced last episode. And when I spoke with her, it was a month before she was moving into a different unit in the building.
They're renovating it right now, but it's completely adaptive for a wheelchair user.
Is the space you're in right now just somewhat barrier-free?
It is. It's accessible. It's not adapted. As you can see, there's no space under the kitchen sink that I could wheel up, right up. And the counters are quite a bit higher. The cupboards are high. And in the adaptive unit, there's countertops are lower. There's no cabinets on top. And I could wheel right under the sink. And the shower is a roll-in shower. I've got a bathtub in my bathroom right now.
Yeah, that would be difficult to get in and out.
It is. It's a challenge. I love my showers, but I hate my showers because it's such a challenge to get in and out of them.
Yeah, it's always nice to feel, like, clean and fresh, but, oh, man, if you have to struggle to do that,
yeah.
That sucks.
Yes, especially when it's hot out, like in the summer, because you go in there to freshen up and cool off. By the time you get out and dried off, you're all hot and sweaty and gross again.
You're like, what was the point of doing it?
Yeah, exactly.
So you've been in this unit for the 7 years that you've been here?
Yes. Yeah, I actually really like the unit. And the unit we're moving into is exactly the same, except everything's opposite. And what's weird is when I first moved in, I had a lot of trouble adapting myself to this unit because everything was on the wrong side for me because I don't use my left arm fully. I have to reach over my whole body to get the light switch.
Yeah, just contort in, essentially.
Yeah, And same with the bathtub. In a lot of condos and apartments, the toilet and stuff is right next to the bathtub. In these units, it's not. So it was hard getting used to standing after I got out of the shower, because usually I would just sit on the toilet and dry off. But the toilet is nowhere near the bathtub, so I couldn't do that. So that was difficult.
Yeah, you're learning all of, like, these new just procedures for day-to-day life.
Well, it seems like people with disabilities are always adapting to their surroundings, right? No matter what.
Every person I spoke to basically said the same thing. People with disabilities have to change to fit their environment because our society isn't designed for them. And yeah, that might sound obvious, but that sucks, especially for your home. Because home is supposed to be your safe space, where you go to recharge and prepare for everything else in your life.
That's right. And how awesome would it be to have a world where you didn't have to worry about that stuff, just like an able-bodied person. Instead of worrying, how am I going to even get in the door? I want to worry about the color on my baseboards. You know, oh, I don't like the paint here. And so it's a real perspective shift when you're coming at it from the lens of a disabled person. People with disabilities have enough shit to deal with, right? Like, with their health, with, you know, getting around in society. You know, every day of my life I plan out to a T, right? So if I need to go to a podcast, what time do I gotta get up and be ready for, you know, to leave? Well, you add an extra hour of prep time, or 2 hours, right? If you have washroom routines or that sort of thing. And then if you're taking public transit, it's winter right now, so okay, I need to take public transit because I didn't qualify for DADS because they said that I could get around independently, even though I'm in a power wheelchair. I have a hard time itching my nose. Now, what about windrows? Like, snow removal. Am I going to get stuck in the snow and potentially freeze to death? Anyways, long story short, you know, you're thinking all the time about, you know, the barriers. So it would be wonderful to not have to worry about how am I going to live in a home.
So I guess before we dive into this more, it might be useful to outline common physical barriers that people might face in housing.
I think for me the top two barriers that I experience are the entrance and the washroom, and then just overall maneuverability. And so if we eliminate those two, I think we're in the right direction. We are nowhere by all means there in terms of an accessible space, just because Zachary said, okay, we need to have a zero grade entrance and a washroom. No, that is not acceptable. We need to broaden our horizons and leverage technology now too, right? So, you know, vibrating beds or alarm clocks or what have you, for those with hearing loss, to let them know it's time to get up, you know, or you know, even just the way a space is designed for those with blindness. and how they navigate from kitchen to washroom or even in the kitchen, right? Like, safely, so they can orient themselves. Again, that's out of my wheelhouse, no pun intended. But, you know, you can, a great guy that I always learn a lot from is Mark Guyanco. So gracious with his knowledge and approach, and yeah, he's another fine fellow.
Yeah, so Mark is another one of my accessibility advisors. He's done extensive work on disability and universal design, and he's also visually impaired. So he's shared the importance about wayfinding and how people can navigate safely with different floor surfaces and types of lighting, etc. The thing about all of these physical barriers, though, is that it's easy to assume that they're just the way things are. But they're not inevitable, right? Like, they didn't just appear. So as we explore what makes community housing accessible or inaccessible, there's a bigger question lurking in the background that we need to address. And that's, where do these barriers even come from? And I think we can trace them back to two main reasons. One, a lack of understanding about accessibility. And two, the tension between affordability and accessibility. There's other reasons, of course, but these might be the most prevalent and relevant. So let's unpack them. Starting with misconceptions. Too often, we approach accessibility as a checkbox, making sure that we include a ramp here and there, or some other features that we can just tick off as we go along. However, accessibility is not just about having the right pieces, it's about whether those pieces actually work together. Here's Michelle again.
Well, for example, the condo I lived in before had an accessible parking spot. And it was wider than most. It had the elevator. It had all of that. Except the door, I couldn't actually get into my own building because there was no automatic door. So lots of times I had to, when I would go out in the neighborhood on my scooter at the time, I had to park my scooter outside and walk in to my suite, like, because I couldn't open the door and get the scooter in. So I had parked it outside, take the keys, and wait until someone was home to bring out my scooter.
Accessibility falls apart very quickly when we don't consider how different users actually move through and experience space. And so, true accessibility requires seeing the whole picture, beyond a particular unit or entrance, to how the building also connects with the wider community.
Like, where I live, Art Space, it's great, the building's great, it's accessible, all that, but there's nothing close. You have to take a bus all the way downtown, and the only corner stores that are close by is the Husky or Hughes, and neither one of them are accessible. And I don't just go out for a walk in this neighborhood because it's not only, well, during the day it's not bad, but in the evenings and whatnot, it's not safe. But the sidewalks and the roads are terrible around here. They're scary. Like, I could get my wheelchair stuck in a crack, not be able to go anywhere. So I don't go anywhere around here unless I go out and take that somewhere. Where I used to live, I was a 10-minute scooter ride from Collingwood Mall. And there was Safeway, there were Shoppers, there were restaurants, there was little clothing stores and boutiques and the Dollarama. And I used to go up there once a week. or more. It was a nice little ride up there, and I could get all my shopping done and carry it all home. But around here I can't, and I really miss it.
For disabled people, finding housing in the city is hard enough. But even when you get a place that works, the neighborhood can still limit you. A criteria of adequate housing is location, being able to access the services you need. And when we talk about accessibility, this principle applies just as much. What I want to get at with both of these issues is how we have a very narrow understanding of accessibility.
We're still stuck in a time where we our watermark is, is there a wheelchair accessible entrance and is there an elevator? Well, we're beyond that now, right? So that was good in the 70s. It's now 2025. Happy New Year, everyone. You know, we need to build beyond the stereotypical societal image of disability that's been pounded down our throats for so long. It's a whole spectrum of where we are on this journey with disability. Maybe it's the way a space is designed. I'm thinking more of a space with shared residences, but we'll build it in a way that maybe it's circular in nature. So if someone has issues with directions, such as myself, you just end up going in a circle, which sort of like my life. But now that I think about that, just going in circles. Yeah, so there's many misconceptions as to, you know, what is accessible.
And unfortunately, this is reflected in community housing. While the sector is still more inclusive and accessible than market housing, it still often equates accessibility solely with wheelchair accessible options, which can be a problem, even for some wheelchair users.
If we could have adjustable height building products like cupboards and everything that we could set to different heights, it may be easier than just doing, okay, for now, Jamie, you're at 36 inches. If somebody else moves in here after we leave and they're in a manual, they are going to be completely having to redo the suite to drop it down to an acceptable level for them. So accessibility needs to be thought of as a universal concept from the time builders put shovels into the ground until it's built and maintained. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
This is Jamie Graham.
I am 45 years old with cerebral palsy and been working in advocacy and now in for-profit with Home Depot for the last 2 years.
You forgot to mention that you went to university and got a BA in business and can't get past the barrier of the wheelchair.
There is that point as well.
I spoke with Jamie and his mom, Colleen, who you heard just there, in their apartment.
Yeah. I have about 2 degrees behind my name, and I spent 7 years in nonprofit doing donation, solicitation, running multiple events for different organizations, and it opened my eyes to how inaccessible this society still is to this day, even when it relates to housing, anything. There is still a long way to go. So that's why I agree to do things like this to have a voice in hopefully the change.
Jamie uses a power wheelchair to get around. And if you caught it earlier, you'll know that he sits higher than a manual chair, partly because he's also tall already. And this is where things get tricky, because a lot of apartments labeled wheelchair accessible don't account for difference in wheelchair users. All of the surfaces are low, which means that they don't work for Jamie or Colleen for that matter. We'll talk about how Jamie and Colleen adapted their current place and some of their problems with it still. But first, I want to highlight how Abbey Road has been a milestone in their housing journey, which has been full of housing options that didn't work for one reason or another.
When we first moved to the city in 1990, we got lucky and got into handicap housing when Ralph Klein and the Conservatives were in power. Great, they said it was accessible. And again, it was the lower counters, but it was accessible. We made it work because at that time, I was in a manual chair more often and dealing with health issues and multiple surgeries, so we made it work up until the powers that be told us to get out of that accessible unit because we were underutilizing it. It was a three-bedroom place. We had my bedroom, my mom's bedroom, and we set up one as a computer study office type area. And they said, nope, you need to leave. So we said, okay, fine, where are we gonna go? They wanted to put us into a one bedroom. We have two of us here, and I'm sorry, love my mom to pieces, but in 700 square feet? No. And all my equipment and everything, it's not gonna work.
Their answer to us when I said a one bedroom, 700 square feet would not work for us, they said, get rid of your furniture. Only bring your necessities that you need. I had bath seats for him. I had lift systems. No, I didn't have a lift system at the time. I had your bath seats, your electric chair, your manual chair, ramps, because I didn't have a wheelchair accessible vehicle at the time. And everything else was supposed to go, not required. We moved to the city because we lived in Grand Prairie at the time. He broke his leg. We had to come down for physio. Well, we might as well make the move. But in over 30 years of living in the city, we've lived in handicapped housing.
Boardwalk.
We've lived in a boardwalk property. We've lived in
Midwest properties.
Yeah, you know, and they were apartments, general, normal apartments, because there was no accessible apartment.
Jamie and Colleen ended up living in a private condo that wasn't technically accessible, especially in the bathroom, but it had an open layout that worked for them. And they ended up staying there for 10 years until, of course, the rent went up. And when it did, they had to leave. That's how they landed at Abbey Road Co-op. As you might recall, Abbey Road was Edmonton's first housing co-op designed with wheelchair users in mind. 23 of its 49 units are adapted for wheelchair accessibility, and they also have integrated independent living supports. So Jamie and Colleen moved into one of the two-bedroom accessible suites in the building, but even then, it wasn't quite right. They had to raise the kitchen counters, knock down a wall for better access and sight lines, redo the bathroom, and, oh yeah, fix the electrical, which they discovered wasn't even grounded.
So basically, what we have done with this place is because we have invested so much in here, we have made this the best that we can because it's our entertainment, it's our social hub, and it's where we feel safe because we know behind the walls is 100% up to 2022 electrical standard. So it's like much safer, and we are probably the only suite in the building that won't catch on fire. And that is the most disturbing part. How can you honestly build something that is unsafe and not maintain it?
I think this is a great point to remind you about the second reason for inaccessible housing, the tension between affordability and accessibility. Because if everyone had the means to create a space that addressed their needs, they would. But people with disabilities often can't afford it. Jamie and Colleen were able to renovate their place, but at a great cost.
She was a poor retirement fund. She sacrificed 95% of her retirement fund is now in this house to make it accessible.
Now, it's worth noting that not every accessibility solution requires renovations. For example, Skylar, who we heard from last episode, she's the mom with fibromyalgia. She installed an Alexa system to help her control the lights on days she can't get up. So there are small things that can make a world of difference, but that isn't enough for some. And unfortunately, despite making their place at Abbey Road accessible for them, Jamie and Colleen might not get to stay much longer.
We are looking at a place that is a new build in the west end of the city. $995. Great. Sounds wonderful. However, this is the same place that says you have to have a 4-inch lip in your bathroom. Or you do not have accessible kitchen. So why would I move from here? I need to move because here the rent will be up to $1,600 in the next 2 years. Nobody can afford that. And that is
even... not at $15 an hour.
Nobody can afford that. And that is even with a $75 subsidy, which has been calculated completely backwards. Because the combined income of my mom and I is not over $40,000. And they are taking 42% of income, when according to subsidy programs, it's only supposed to be 30, which means this place should only cost $1,000. Instead, it's going to be $1,600 by 2026. How is that affordable? Because I'm not made of money. Neither is my mom. Neither is half the people that need accessible housing.
Jamie put it to me bluntly. They invested all that time and money into making this place work, only to face the cruel reality that none of it will be there for them when they can no longer afford to stay. And if they want another accessible home that comes remotely close to what they've done, they'll need to spend another $30,000 or more, which they do not have, to do the process over again. And by the way, isn't possible in most rental options anyway. A quick technical note, this next clip has some fridge hum I couldn't fully remove, but it ends after a bit.
They basically tell you when you move in here, it's like, good luck, where are you gonna go? Unless you're working, which most of these people in here do not work. The ones that work have the support and backing to do work. If I didn't have my mom being willing to help me get up or do whatever for work, I'd be literally watching the world go by. I am literally scared for the day when she is not physically able to do what she does, because the systems that are in place to help people live independently do not work. We have the care aides in here, but on any whim, they could call in sick, and then you're stuck in your bed or wherever you happen to be. It all comes down to accessibility being more than just grab bars in a suite. It's a universal term that everybody needs to understand. And yes, it can be different for everybody, but we can make some unilateral decisions when we are building places that would make it easier. And that is what needs to happen. I don't like it. It will happen before I am not on the...
It might happen when you're retired. When you're retired, it may be in place, but I will never see that day.
Yeah.
And most likely, some government official will snap it and say, no, they don't need that. We've got all these long-term care places that are empty because all the seniors have passed away.
And that's where they want you to go, is because of care needs, you are classified and put into places. Like, if this place doesn't exist as it is today, in 3 years, we will all be put into long-term care. How do you go from living on your own to long-term care? I have friends that I have known, they have been in long-term care since the day they were 30 years old because their parents did not want to stick around to help them learn to be independent or vice versa. And it's under 30 years old being thrown into a long-term care. Come on.
Well, it's not even long-term care, because we've gone through and talked to numerous senior living facilities. And I said, you know, it's just my body's starting to give out. I need to take some downtime. And they go, well, you can live here, but your son will have to live in a dementia ward.
Yeah.
A dementia ward.
Yes.
Because that's where they have all the equipment, the lifts, the
staff,
more staff and all this other stuff.
But you are then labeled and said, you can only come out between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m.
Yeah, look, we've got a lot to fix when it comes to accessibility, and we'll dig into that more later. But even with all its flaws, community housing, it's still the most accessible option out there and the most affordable, which is kind of depressing, honestly, but also weirdly hopeful, because if this broken system is somehow the best we've got, then fixing it could actually change things. And it's also a chance to rebuild our collective understanding about what accessibility means. Which I think Michelle, who we heard at the top of the episode, she had a really great definition that we can all learn from.
What it means is being able to live where you want, not where you have to, and being comfortable in your own home, and being able to access anything in your own home, and have people over, like easy access to get into your own home and stuff. Whether that be meaning an elevator in the building or a parking space that you can access. Doesn't necessarily mean just in the building or your own unit. It's fine to have a double wide parking spot, but if people accidentally park in there, you might not be able to get your chair out. Or the accessible parking stall might be the furthest away from the door. You know, so that's more. So being included, being comfortable, just not worrying about stuff you shouldn't have to worry about. Like, is the elevator working? Am I going to be able to get into my bathtub tonight or have a shower tonight? Not to be able to think twice about those things, you know? And it shouldn't be an issue. Ever, but it always is. Disability covers every demographic, absolutely every demographic. So if we solve the issues for people with disabilities or bring it to the forefront, instead of an afterthought, every demographic then is taken care of. You know, for example, years ago at City Center, like I'm dating myself, but years ago, there was this thing where people were asking them to put in a ramp for people who use wheelchairs. Well, they put in a ramp and then they sat there to see how many people would actually use the little ramp instead of the stairs, because they honestly thought no one would use the ramp. Well, everybody used the ramp. Well, duh, do that in the first place. So, and then you make it easier on the elderly, moms with strollers, just people carrying armfuls of stuff. Like automatic doors, you just hit it with your elbow, you know? So if we put disability first, make it easier for everybody. And practical, actually.
The thing about accessibility in community housing is that a lot of the time, the buildings are just old. And old buildings mean old rules. They were built under whatever codes existed at the time, and unless someone's gone through the trouble and expense of updating them, they're just kind of frozen that way.
No, and you raise a great point in that, you know, we're in a situation where buildings have been built at different times, and therefore everything goes according to what the building code was at that time. So that adds another layer of barrier to accessibility, because what was expected in the 70s by no means is close to what should be incorporated nowadays. And, you know, we only need to update the accessibility if XYZ. Well, guess what? They make it so that, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they go out of their way to not alter things, so then we don't have to incorporate this and that. And again, it all comes down to money, I get it, but, you know, the building code in itself is a minimum, right? So that is another challenge that I face as an advocate, in that I'm advocating for universal design. Talked about that earlier. Well, the code says I only need to have this, that, and the other thing. Right? So we need to make the code better, right? So, and that's when the rubber really hits the road, or meets the road, rather. Because if that's what they're defaulting to, or we are defaulting to as a society, then let's change it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and then they say, well, how can we change it? It's you know, so complex, blah, blah. You know, listen, all these codes were written by humans. We can change the code. Like, how did we get the code to begin with?
Yeah, it wasn't a divinely intervention.
Right. It's not like it just appeared from the creator or what have you, right? So, you know, it is possible. And as the saying goes, the strongest impact can be made with the stroke of a pen. And that's where, again, I encourage listeners to look within themselves and have an honest conversation of, am I really doing what I can now to make the best during my time on Earth?
That's the frustrating part. We have all the knowledge we need to build accessible housing. Disabled people have basically provided us with the blueprints to do it. And we know it's cheaper to do it right the first time. And yet, most community housing still falls short. If accessibility, or inclusion, is part of the mission for this housing sector, why does this issue persist? Well, the answer lives in that gap between what should be and what is. In aging buildings and bureaucratic systems where accessibility competes with a dozen other priorities. Next time, we're pulling back the curtain on the bureaucracy of community housing and exploring why systems designed to help often end up working against the people they're meant to serve. Accessing Home is created by me and is supported by Community Housing Canada, a research partnership funded by the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. My research is also supported by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. Music in this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions, a repository of free music for podcasters. It also features Hard Living by John Bartman from freemusicarchive.org. Big thanks to Michelle Bissell, Jamie Graham, and Colleen Graham for speaking with me in this episode. I want to also shout out the artist extraordinaire Amanda Trillos for helping out with the podcast visuals, and CJSR 88.5 FM for the use of their studios. By the way, I have an update on the coffin story from last episode. Remember how I couldn't find any photos of it? Well, Karen dug through her archives and uncovered something special. Images from other demonstrations where they used the same coffin. I've added them to the show notes if you want to see what these direct actions really look like. I'm Megan Miller.
I'm Zachary Weeks.
Thanks for listening.